people becoming Shia. It's not about that.
No, it's not about a conversion business.
It's about,
no.
You know, call yourself whatever you want.
Want, yes.
Just look at the teaching of Ahlul Bayt.
Right, and learn about Islam.
And you will see
yes.
that this is what's fitra. This is your fitra.
Exactly.
If you read Nahjul Balagha, if you read Saifa Sajjadiyah by Imam Sajjad, alayhi salam, Imam Sajjad, Saifa Sajjadiyah is a miracle. Mm. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing.
Of course.
And if you're Arab and you understand Arabic, you know, it will immediately touch your heart. You will understand that this person is not a normal person. That this person is the one that's following and continuing the tradition of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and is the successor of the Prophet.
And trying to lead us towards perfection.
I'm talking about Imam Sajjad. And Saifa Sajjadiyah and the prayers that are in there. And the way he talks to God.
Mm.
Okay? Anybody who has a heart, anybody who is a little bit sincere, if you read Saifa Sajjadiyah, how can you not be moved by it?
Exactly.
How can you be not by touched by it as a Muslim? So this is my message, is that don't be fooled.
Mm.
Takfiris are not Sunnis. It's not about labels. It's about following real Islam.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note, I'd like to thank you for your valuable contribution on the program today. I hope our listeners have benefited from what you've said today. Thank you very much for that. And for our listeners, it just leaves me to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye. The limelight.
As the U.S. Senate prepares to confirm Nolan for Under Secretary for Political Affairs, a reflection of her last 30 years in government shows how she was connected to nearly every foreign policy disaster undertaken by the United States. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Rick Sterling, journalist. This article is published under the heading Queen of Chicken Hawks. Victoria Nuland had a hand in every U.S. intervention in the past 30 years. Here's the details. U.S. President Joe Biden's nomination of Victoria Nuland for Under Secretary for Political Affairs, the third highest position at the State Department, is a dangerous sign. Nuland exemplifies the neoconservatives who have led American foreign policy from one disaster to another for the past 30 years, all while evading any shred of accountability. As a top-level appointee, Nuland must still be confirmed by the Senate. And while pro-peace groups have waged a campaign to stop her confirmation, reflecting on her career in public service makes clear why she is incompetent, highly dangerous, and should not be confirmed. From 2000 to 2003, when the Bush administration attacked and then invaded Afghanistan, Nuland was serving as Bush's permanent representative to NATO. After Al-Qaeda was defeated, the U.S. could have left Afghanistan but instead stayed, established semi-permanent bases, splintered the country, and is still fighting there for two decades. From 2003 to 2005, Nolan was principal foreign policy advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, who helped plan and manage the war that toppled Saddam Hussein, including making the Bush administration's case for preemptive military action based on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. The foreign policy establishment, including Nolan, insisted that removing Saddam Hussein and installing a U.S. ally would be simple. The invasion and continuing occupation have resulted in over a million dead Iraqis, many thousands of dead Americans, hundreds of thousands with PTSD, and a bill for American taxpayers of $2 to $6 trillion. From 2005 to 2008, Nolan served as U.S. ambassador to NATO, where her role was to strengthen Allied support for the occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. When Nolan was asked about the lessons learned on the 10th anniversary of the invasion, she responded, "Compared to where we were in the Saddam era, we now have a bilateral security agreement. We have deep economic interests and ties. We have a security relationship. We have a political relationship." Nolan's response makes clear that she is oblivious to the cost, and that her loyalties are to the elite who are still benefiting from the tragedy. Indeed, one of the top profiteers from the Iraqi war was Oil Field Services Corporation Halliburton. Halliburton gained $39.5 billion in federal contracts related to the Iraqi war. Nolan's boss, Vice President Dick Cheney, was its former CEO. In January 2020, 17 years after U.S. invasion, the Iraqi parliament passed a resolution demanding U.S. troops and contractors withdraw from their country. Now, over 1 year later, they still have not left. In the spring of 2011, Nolan became State Department spokesperson under then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as she ramped up the regime change assault on longtime U.S. ally Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. UN Security Council Resolution 1973 authorized a no-fly zone for the protection of civilians, but not an air assault on Libyan government forces. Yet that summer, as the U.S. and her NATO allies bombed and attacked Libyan forces, Nolan dismissed the option of a peaceful transition in Libya and suggested falsely that the UN Security Council required the removal of Gaddafi. The bombing campaign led to the toppling of the Libyan government and the brutal public murder of Gaddafi at the hands of anti-government rebels. Commenting on the murder, Nolan's boss, Hillary Clinton, now famously quoted, "We came, we saw, he died." Before Gaddafi's overthrow, Libya had the highest standard of living in all of Africa. Since the U.S.-led assault, though, it has become a failed state with competing warlords, huge inflation, huge unemployment, and exploding extremism and violence that has spread to neighboring countries. Most of the migrants who have crossed the Mediterranean trying to reach Europe or drown trying to are coming from Libya. By any measure, the goal of protecting Libyan civilians has failed spectacularly. One reason that Clinton and hawks like Nolan wanted to overthrow Gaddafi was ostensibly to gain access to Libya's military arsenal. Doing so would allow them to funnel arms to insurgents seeking to overthrow the Syrian government and any other enemy of the United States or her allies in the region. In September 2013, Nolan was appointed to the post of Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. The uprising in Ukraine's Maidan Central Plaza began soon after her arrival. To underscore American support for the protests, Nolan and Senator John McCain passed out bread and cookies to a crowd of anti-government protesters. The protests continued into January of 2014. The issue at hand was a loan from the International Monetary Fund, which would require a 40% increase in natural gas bills, or to accept a loan from Russia with the inclusion of cheap oil and gas. The opposition, wary of Russia and in favor of Ukraine's alignment with Western powers, wanted the Yanukovych government to accept the IMF loan. That opposition was comprised of different factions, including the neo-Nazi Svoboda Party and right sector. But Nolan's cursing was a distraction from what was truly significant of the recording. It showed the extent to which Nolan was meddling in domestic Ukrainian affairs, had direct contacts with key opposition leaders, and was managing the protest to the extent she was deciding who would and would not have a seat at the table in the post-coup government. Victoria Nuland has promoted a foreign policy of intervention, coups, proxy wars, aggression and occupation, and that policy has been implemented with bloody and disastrous results in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria and Ukraine. With consummate hypocrisy, she falsely accuses Russia of spreading disinformation in the United States, while she openly seeks to put stress on Putin. She wants to establish permanent bases along NATO's eastern border and increase the pace and visibility of joint training exercises. Nolan is the queen of chicken hawks, the Lady Macbeth of perpetual war. There are hundreds of thousands of victims from the policies she has promoted, yet she has not received a scratch. On the contrary, she has profited from a stock portfolio likely filled with military contractors. Now, Nolan wants to provoke, threaten, and roll back Russia. Yet a quick look at any map of U.S. military bases shows who is threatening whom. Victoria Nolan is highly dangerous and should not be confirmed.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello and welcome to The Light. If you walk through London these days, you will spot tiny handmade shops in some places. The shops have been created by an artist to encourage people to donate non-perishable food to charities. Sean Rodrigo makes wooden miniature food banks and puts them in different areas. He uses a 3D printer to create his artwork. Rodrigo believes decorated boxes shaped like shops grab people's attention. Each box holds about 35 cans.
It's really difficult and often painful to put a smile on kids' faces, especially when they're sick and they are suffering from chronic diseases. But a group in superhero costumes in Austria has taken a courageous move to cheer up young patients on International Childhood Cancer Day. Vienna's special forces police officers agreed to visit the children's hospital dressing up as Spider-Man, Batman, and other superheroes. The young patients were excited and delighted to see them through windows while they scrawled on the walls of the hospital. The officers' brass band also played familiar songs from Star Wars to amuse the children. The visit was planned by hospital officials and volunteer officers in order to cheer up these little warriors who are fighting the diseases every day.
Thai brides and grooms have said, "I do," in a special wedding ceremony on Valentine's Day. 59 couples tied the knot on elephants during the ceremony in Thailand's Chamburi province. The elephant bag wedding is actually an annual event. It takes place in a botanical garden. In previous years, over 100 couples attended the ceremony, but this year, the number was half that due to the pandemic.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
Chinese villagers cook local dishes as they mark the start of the Lunar New Year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated throughout East Asia and has always been the most important holiday of the year in that region. For many people, it's a two-week celebration culminating in fireworks, red envelopes with gifts, and most importantly, a sumptuous feast. The elaborate meal preparation allows the family to spend more time together and celebrate the new year. The auspicious symbolism of these traditional foods is based on their pronunciations and appearances. Not only do the dishes themselves matter, but also the preparation and ways of serving and even enjoying them mean a lot. In the northwestern province of Shanxi, villagers use a 3,000-year-old recipe to make huamou, a kind of flowery steamed bun in a variety of festive shapes, including Chinese zodiacs. As you know, 2021 is the lunar year of the ox.
Australia is offering environmentally friendly kayak tours in Sydney Harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month, about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organizers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. It's not. I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally each year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean. People throughout China and in many countries across the globe have begun celebrations marking the start of Chinese Lunar New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. February the 12th is the beginning of the Year of the Ox, based on the Chinese calendar. A variety of activities featuring traditional Chinese culture and folk performances mark the occasion in China and neighboring states Malaysia, Japan, and Vietnam. Releasing lanterns and setting off fireworks are part of the event. It's also the time for families to be together as the day starts with a week-long official public holiday. The festive mood is also seen in Europe as well as in Australia. Sydney was one of the first cities to kick off celebrations.
It's meant to be a year of economic prosperity, which we need after COVID, a year of good health, which we need so we can, you know, mix and get back to a normal way of life. But it would be good if we had good relations with all of our neighbours.
The Italian city of Milan also joined the celebrations, with its highest building being lit up in red for the fourth consecutive year. Every year, millions of people in China and elsewhere in the world welcome and celebrate the Spring Festival. The occasion attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists to China. However, border closures and travel bans due to the COVID-19 pandemic have reduced the crowd this year, forcing many people to sit home and watch the festivities online.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
The German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
We get people.
Legacy of Donald Trump.
If Donald Trump's presidency was hysterical, the last few weeks of his term were unprecedented in so many ways, even by his standards. The world witnessed scenes that most never imagined they would see transpire in Washington. The American exceptionalism and its pretense of democracy were shattered following a tumultuous election that left America divided more than ever. The US doesn't seem to be able to handle what is going on, and everyone feels things are spinning out of control. Where does America go from here? Will the world see the United States in the same way again? Hello and welcome to you from around the world. I'm Mila Javamardi. We're back with a new edition of We the People after a 3-month hiatus. Let's get started.
In January 2017, Donald Trump stood in front of the U.S. Capitol and promised to end this American carnage as he was being sworn into office.
Together, we will determine the course of America and the world for many, many years to come.
4 years later, Trump incited his supporters to storm the very same building in an attempt to overturn his election defeat. The siege on the so-called citadel of American democracy exposed how fragile that democracy actually is. The police largely stood by as thousands of white pro-Trump supporters smashed their way into the building. Five people were killed. The last time Congress was attacked was during a British invasion in 1814. President Trump was impeached for an unprecedented second time and charged with incitement of an insurrection. Can America ever be restored to what it was before Trump came to power? As Richard Haass, head of the Council on Foreign Relations, said following the Capitol riot, if the post-America era has a start date, it is almost certainly today. For many around the world, the vision of that shiny city on the hill has already died a thousand deaths.
To get to the bottom of all of this, we have invited two experts to the show to discuss Trump's legacy and what it means for the US and the rest of the world. Let's start with Cheryl Labash, political activist and writer from Michigan. Cheryl, how do you think Donald Trump will be judged in history?
Well, I think he's going to be judged as the president who tore the mask off the image of democracy in the United States. He enriched the already wealthy at the expense of working class and poor people, and at the same time trying to turn the hostility of those people who were being impoverished onto immigrants, Muslims, and on people of color in general.
I was also joined by John Bosnich, a Canadian journalist, consultant, and political activist from New York. John told me he believes Trump's opponents are trying to put a spin on the Capitol violence to tarnish his legacy.
At this time, in these days, immediately following the incident at the Capitol building, of course, there is an intense pressure against President Trump by his opponents who are now moving into office. So, in the short term, negative. In the longer term, positive. That's the weight of history that will weigh in on his side.
The assault on the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters was the predictable outcome of his 4 years of fanning the flames of hate, division, racism, and bigotry.
These are animals.
Oh, look at my African-American over here. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Trump quickly turned his anti-immigrant sentiment against Muslims. He continued to use Twitter, his favorite social media platform, to spread Islamophobia. And as president, he introduced a sweeping travel ban on Muslims. But to blame everything that's gone wrong with America today solely on Donald Trump would be a fallacy.
To understand what is happening in America today, the underlying causes of Trump's rise to power must be addressed. The question many are asking is this: was Trump an aberration or the symptom of a deeper problem?
Well, I think that he unmasked what's been underlying a lot of the problems here inside the United States. It's true he's eroded public trust in the institutions, but it's very interesting that the murder of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and the stalking of racist stalking of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia show that there's a maturing understanding that the United States has actually been founded on the genocide of indigenous people and on the unpaid labor of Africans who were enslaved and brought to this country.
As a result of Trump's presidency, Americans have begun to have a better understanding of their judicial system, law enforcement, prison system, and the underlying racism that's part and parcel of the fabric of the United States.
You know, it seems that he has deepened the racial and cultural divides because of the racist character of what happened on January 6th and the fascist character of what happened on January 6th. In fact, there is a very broad, multi-ethnic, multi-generational movement in this country to revitalize democracy.
John says that not only Trump is not an aberration, he's actually a magnifying glass on the inner workings of the U.S. government.
Trump has come into government as an outsider, And as an outsider, he was not burdened with the baggage or the lies or propaganda of previous sides in the political divide. Trump has focused not just domestic, but world interest and involvement in American affairs. And what he has revealed to the world has been hidden from the public for more than 2 to 3 generations since World War II.
Perhaps Trump was not an anomaly after all. He is a reflection of the ugliness that has been a part of U.S. society for so long. Trump has simply awakened from the dark shadows of U.S. history, a strand of America that's prone to violence, intolerance, and racism. The idea that the riots of today simply represent the flickering embers of the Trump era is a delusion. The foundation of division has been cast long before Trump took office.
He didn't do it himself. He is a product of the division and the disintegration of society in the United States. It's a very dangerous time, but it is a time that we all need to band together against war, against racism, and for a better life for all the people, not for the rich.
Trump's rise to power has been decades in the making, a testament to the fact that the struggles of the civil rights movement are not a thing of the past.
In the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. And it has failed to hear that large segment of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. And so in a real sense, our nation summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay.
Those words by the late Martin Luther King still ring true today, more than half a century later. Trump's rise to power is a result of decades upon decades of division and inequality that successive U.S. leaders have either failed to address or manipulated to their advantage. This is an ongoing, unfinished project in the American life. Will America's divides be healed?
As hopeful as people look at the Biden-Harris, we have to worry that they're not going to go far enough. And it's up to people, the rank and file, the people in our communities and our workplaces, to build the kind of decisive movement that will reject all the racism, the xenophobia, the anti-immigrant bias that the Trump administration really represented.
Some analysts believe that Trump himself has actually started a movement in American politics that will live long after he's out of office, a movement that has reorganized and reshaped the political system in the United States. Let's see what John has to say.
We are going to see the movement that Donald Trump has assembled take a shape and form that goes beyond him. He is the creator and the starter of this movement, and that has actually created a new third force in American politics. Trump has empowered a group of not less than 40% to 50% of the American electorate to become a part of the political question and a part of the political discussion.
During his tenure as president, Trump frequently used the justice system to shield himself and his political allies from prosecution and to punish his political enemies. He proclaimed people guilty or not guilty before trial. He preemptively pardoned dozens of his associates, all convicted of federal crimes.
Donald Trump doesn't surprise us anymore. What he does is always and only in his self-interest, and so he is rewarding people who he regarded as being useful to him.
Trump stretched presidential power beyond the limits of the law. He was a law unto himself. What does Trump's behavior say about the system that allows such conduct? After all, Trump didn't create the system. He only exploited it.
Well, actually, what he's done is he's shown that the rich have always been able to escape accountability. That is has been a hallmark of the U.S. society, where, as he said early on in his administration, if I stood in the middle of Fifth Avenue and killed somebody and shot somebody, that people would still vote for me.
Every week, we'll reach out to our friend and colleague from the United States, Danny Haifong, to get his take on the issues we're discussing in the show. Let's see what Danny has to say today. Hello, Danny.
Thank you, Milad. Our topic this week centers on how Trump has deepened racial and cultural divides in America, pitting Americans against each other. I'll show you why this is in keeping with the United States' political legacy. Trump has certainly magnified racial inequality and class divides in the United States. His administration enriched the profits of big corporations while scapegoating immigrants in China for the economic fallout. His foreign policy sought to make America great by tearing apart international treaties and waging wars of aggression against Venezuela and Iran. But Trump's presidency did not occur in a vacuum. In fact, incoming President Joe Biden was a major player in laying the conditions for Trump's rise. Biden represents a nearly five-decade-long bipartisan consensus in Washington, D.C. on waging endless war abroad and enforcing austerity at home. This includes the institutionalization of racist policies, which gave way for Trump's ideology. In more than four decades in political office, Biden collaborated with segregationist Republicans to erect the largest mass incarceration system in the world and build a massive deportation system targeted toward undocumented immigrants. Biden and his colleagues also backed the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and supported proxy wars in Libya and Syria in 2011, all of which spurred the greatest refugee crisis in human history. To pay for these wars, Biden and the Democrats forged a grand bargain with Republicans to deregulate Wall Street and increase the U.S. military budget to record heights. Trump indeed ended his presidency as a national embarrassment following the January 6th riots on Capitol Hill. But try as Washington might to distance themselves from Donald Trump, he is no aberration. Trump is a symptom of a larger systemic disease that champions racial hatred, corporate domination, and endless interventionism to make America great.
History looms large over Trump's presidency and what it represents. In many ways, Trump has only exposed the fundamental flaws of a failed system, the lies that form the bedrock of American exceptionalism, the notion that it's fine for U.S. rebels to fight and overthrow regimes that Washington dislikes, but is totally unacceptable when Americans rebel against their own government.
We are supporting the hopes of Cubans, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans to restore democracy the United States is leading.
Do Americans realize that the Capitol Hill violence is exactly what Washington has incited in Hong Kong, Venezuela, Belarus, Syria, Iran, and elsewhere? How has Trump's foreign policy, characterized by his America First approach, changed the U.S. role in the world?
America First is actually a it's a falsehood. It was a sham to try to persuade the masses of people in the United States that they have been aggrieved by the world, by it being other countries. The fact of the matter is, the people in the United States have been impoverished because of the capitalist system.
Trump's America First approach to foreign policy alienated many of America's traditional allies and undermined alliances like NATO. He unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from multiple international treaties and organizations, including the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Climate Accord, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the UN Human Rights Council. Trump's damaging and unnecessary trade war with China put the entire global trade system in jeopardy. Trump promised to end U.S. wars and redirect the money spent overseas to make America great again. What did Trump's presidency achieve on the world stage?
Even though there was a lot of rhetoric about there was action toward fomenting war and destruction and conflict instead of peace and solidarity that's so needed around the world, there's no other way to go forward. The threat of war with China, which I believe is a very real threat based on the United States, the threat of war with Iran, the regime change operations, even though Trump tried to put himself off as a peace president. In fact, he was not a peace president.
Tensions in the Middle East reached a boiling point under Trump. His core approach in the Middle East was the advancement of an Arab-Israeli alliance against Iran. He pursued a strategy of so-called maximum pressure against Iran after withdrawing from the historic 2015 nuclear deal.
The deal lifted crippling economic sanctions on Iran in exchange for very weak limits on the regime's nuclear activity, and no limits at all.
I asked our guests what he thinks of Trump's policy in the Middle East.
Donald Trump's association with his greatest and largest donor in the United States, Mr. Adelson, who is a Jewish, was unfortunately passed away. Mr. Adelson was a major Zionist Jewish supporter of Israel in America. Because of the incredible amount of money that Donald Trump received from this donor, Donald Trump ended up finding himself being the agent of Israel in international affairs in that region, rather than having the superpower America direct Israel as to how it should behave.
As a result, Trump generally focused on making concessions to the Israeli regime, bolstering the occupation, weakening the Palestinians, and pressuring Arab states to end regional isolation of Israel.
Israel is a settler state. It's basically a genocidal installation in the Middle East to do the bidding of the United States and the oil monopolies here. What is happening is the Palestinians continue to be not only segregated, killed, starved, walled in. Their communities have been destroyed. Illegal settlements are placed on the destruction of Palestinian towns, and this is what this president has held up as a good thing, and then building this alliance against Iran.
Trump brought the entire region to the brink of military conflict by illegally ordering the assassination of Iran's senior commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
On this episode of We the People, we're sitting down with Brazilian journalist Natalia Urban. Natalia, thank you so much for joining us. Now, the Trump administration has damaged the credibility of the U.S. government among the international community to what many observers would say is a point of no return by doing things like unilaterally ending the JCPOA with Iran, exiting the Paris Climate Accord, and ending all the arms limitation treaties with Russia. So basically, we want to know, can the U.S. ever be trusted as a reliable partner again from the perspective of its allies in the Latin American region and beyond?
Well, I think it's a great and very complicated question, because the United States has some history, especially in Latin America, of interference especially coming from the Democrats. We have to remember that the Democrats were behind all the latest coup d'etat that the region suffered, like in Brazil, in Honduras, in Paraguay, with the case of Rafael Correa in Ecuador. So the Democrats are not to be trusted. But what Trump did, especially with Brazil, was very unique, because Bolsonaro, in his mind, he was actually friends with Trump. He was not just two presidents talking with each other, like making politics, diplomacy. No, he thought that they were really friends. So Bolsonaro conceded lots of things that Trump wanted, and it was not what was ideal or even good for Brazil. Like, for example, Trump had a very malignant influence in BRICS. Brazil now is in a terrible position within the countries of BRICS, especially with Russia and China. Because of Trump's politics, Brazil started to make personal attacks against China, against Russia. And Brazil is not cooperating with BRICS banks anymore. And one of the last things Mike Pompeo said when he was still Secretary of State was that the India and Brazil had realized how dangerous was to trust in China and Russia. So I think it was a major on their plans was to make the BRICS the most wicked as possible.
We want to thank Natalia Urban so much for joining us for We the People. I'm Wyatt Reed in Washington. Take care.
Historians believe that it will be years, perhaps decades, before the consequences of Trump's presidency are fully known. If Americans not only hold Trump accountable, but also embark on the hard road of reform to address the underlying problems that gave rise to his presidency, then there is a hope of a better future. If not, then history will only repeat itself. That's it for this edition of We the People with me, Mila Javamag. Take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
Saudi Arabia had such an eventful week that 2 days after both Abha Airport and King Khalid military base were targeted inside the kingdom, the Yemeni armed forces once again targeted Abha Airport on Saturday in retaliation for the continuous Saudi aggression on Yemen. The spokesperson of the Yemeni armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sariah, announced that the attack operation on a military target at Abha Airport with a Samad 3 drone was accurate. Sariah took to Twitter saying this was a retaliatory attack in response to the aggression's raids, military escalation, and continuous siege on the Yemeni people. This retaliation followed a busy week for the Yemeni armed forces, where they targeted sensitive military sites at Abha International Airport and King Khalid Base in Khamis al-Shayt with 3 Qasif 2K Yemeni-made drones. That also followed another retaliatory attack targeting the airfields of warplanes at the airport itself with Samad 3 and Qasif 2K bomber drones, achieving accurate strikes, according to the armed forces. The latest attack at Abha Airport suggests the Yemeni armed forces will would continue a high tempo of cross-border operations against Saudi Arabia in an attempt to push the Saudis to stop their continuous aggression and blockade. In the meantime, Saudi occupation forces in eastern Ma'rib began to withdraw gradually after the Yemeni armed forces approached the city. Yemeni armed forces stepped up offensive against the last stronghold of pro-Saudi fighters in Ma'rib province following renewed clashes earlier last week. As fighting took place about 10 kilometers west of Ma'rib city, the Yemeni armed forces also captured the Kawfal military camp from coalition-backed troops in the north of the province. All these developments come 1 week after U.S. President Joe Biden announced an end to support of Saudi-led coalition operations in Yemen and halted some arms sales to the kingdom. However, since in no way that meant ending the Saudi aggression against Yemen, it seems the Yemeni armed forces will continue to take matters into their own hands to rid the Yemeni nation from Mohammed bin Salman's warmongering psychosis. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The missile force affiliated with the government of Sana'a targeted King Khalid Air Base in Khamis Mshayt in the Asir region, southern Saudi Arabia, with a ballistic missile that has not yet been revealed. This attack came shortly after the Yemeni armed forces targeted last week the garrison of the warplanes at Abha International Airport with Samad 3 and Qasif 2 drones. Now, to discuss this issue that's happening in Yemen with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, who's the founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you for being with us, Patrick. How do you see these fast-paced retaliatory developments in Yemen against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? I mean, will this Yemeni strategy finally push Mohammed bin Salman to a place where he would stop the attack against the people of the Yemen and the aerial, the sea, and the land blockade against an entire nation? Or will it actually push him further for more war crimes?
Yes, this is a long-burning question that people have been asking themselves now for the last 5 years. So certainly it's a game changer, the asymmetric aspect of how this conflict has developed, and it seems to have gone into the favor of the resistance, Ansarullah in this case, or the Houthis as they're known in the West, by the West. So, but in terms of how committed Saudi Arabia is in the face of all of these things that are really going against the war that they've been prosecuting now for going on 6 years, it really depends on the long-term agenda. What is the long-term agenda of Saudi Arabia? But more importantly, what is the long-term agenda of those backing Saudi Arabia, the more powerful countries in the West, like the United States, like Britain, like France, that are really backing this effort by Saudi and the UAE in this war that doesn't make any sense on the surface, but certainly there is a geopolitical and geostrategic objective in the back. They're just not talking about it right now. So it depends how committed Mohammed bin Salman is to that long-term agenda, which we're not completely clear about.
Well, the spokesperson of the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sariya, announced that the surface-to-surface ballistic missile, which was used against Abha Airport, was actually, and which targeted, King Khalid Air Base, was of a new generation that has not yet been revealed by the armed forces. Now, the increasing Yemeni military capabilities here has really dumbfounded the leaders of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition in all its entirety. However, do you think that it will be enough to make the upper hand in the war a Yemeni upper hand?
I think it already is a Yemeni upper hand now, because that southwest region in Saudi Arabia is completely exposed, and that's really down to a revolution in military affairs really benefiting the Yemeni resistance, in this case, the Yemeni forces there. So when you have a cruise missile or surface-to-surface cruise missile technology, even a basic technology or capability, that means that, you know, there's whole regions there in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia that are not going to be safe. In other words, the kingdom can't guarantee the security of its own people. And when you have that situation in a conflict in such close quarters, certainly then the ruling regime has to think about whether they're going to have the people supporting them on this, and what does that mean for a government that's you know, constantly in flux and currently in somewhat of turmoil. I think that's without question. So are they going to be able to continue prosecuting this in the face of that? Probably not for a long period of time. I think they're really playing, they're gambling in Riyadh right now. They're gambling that somehow this is going to turn out better than it is. I think this war was meant to be done and dusted probably around 2016, 2017, and it's just gone from bad to worse for Saudi Arabia and those powers that are allying and backing.
What was really interesting this week, though, Patrick, was that alongside the drones, the bomber drones attack against Saudi military bases, we also saw an advancement for Ansarullah and the Yemen armed forces in Ma'arib city, that's in Ma'arib province in the northern part of the country. What happened, and which was very interesting, really, that they reached an agreement there. Ansarullah reached an agreement with the tribal sheikhs in Ma'arib city, which ended up neutralizing two fronts, that's the western and the southwestern parts of the Ma'arib city. The Yemen armed forces are advancing fast, to be honest with you, both for their military maneuvering and for the agreements that they are doing and they are signing with the tribes of Ma'arib. How did the Saudis not see this one coming after occupying the area for 5 years? Didn't they know that the sheikhs were actually not going on along with them?
This is the story for any occupation in a situation like this. It's only ever going to be short term. I mean, Ma'arib is probably regarded as the heartland, if you will, of Yemen, and that's really the last stronghold in the north for Saudi Arabia, UAE, and its coalition there. And they're really just hanging on by threads. I mean, desperately begging the people to help them from these invaders coming from the hills. But really, it's just a question of it's attrition. You can't occupy a foreign country or a region like that forever. And so they're calling it the internationally recognized government, if you noticed, and that's the international line on the government in Yemen, the Western-backed, Saudi-backed government, and they're saying internationally recognized government forces are trying to maintain a hold of Ma'arib, but it's a lot of it is narrative, a lot of it is international hyperbole oriented for a Western audience to try to recharacterize this conflict into something that clearly it is not, and now reality is coming to roost.
What's also being oriented to the Western audience is the calls by the new president, the U.S. President Joe Biden, who was calling for an end of the war. By the way, he can't stop the war, but he just called for an end for the war and lifting the siege, banning the arms sales to countries of aggression against Yemen. All of these things are actually good things. They are certainly positive. However, Ansarullah, the Yemeni armed forces, the upper hand in this war, they said that they are not ready to start any sort of talks until and unless the war stops and the blockade is lifted. Do you think Saudi Arabia will actually be okay with this? Will they accept this? And if they don't, if Mohammed bin Salman just continues with the war machine, what options do the Yemenis have?
This is an incredible development. Just in a couple of days, I suppose the Biden administration will be lifting the terrorist designation for Ansarullah or the Houthis. Hopefully they do that accurately, by the way, that it's not split in some administrative interpretation of Houthis and the political resistance and legitimate movement, which is Ansarullah. But that aside, that's supposed to allow aid to come in. So keeping this embargo, really using starvation as a weapon, I think that's kind of Saudi Arabia. And the United States is in the background. They've been helping all along with this. But now Biden, who under Obama started this war, we can't forget, in March of 2015, now they're doing a pivot because clearly it's not gone well. So the natural progression here is going to be the narrative will come out in the West. Both sides are morally in the wrong, and the people are suffering, so we need to broker a ceasefire. And, of course, the United States, the Biden administration, is positioning itself to be that broker to great international recognition and fanfare and so forth. But really, what do they want at the end of this? Clearly, the U.S. wants to balkanize Yemen. And I think that was the objective from the beginning, is to partition the country like they tried to do in Libya but failed, like they tried to do in Syria but failed, like they successfully did in Sudan in 2010. So to keep Yemen from being a self-sufficient, independently governed country and a really key choke point there in the Gulf of Aden for international trade going forward for the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. That's what I think the agenda is. We'll see if it actually plays out.
Definitely. It's going to be a very interesting couple of weeks to come to see if this war will come to an end or this is just a bargain that the Biden administration is trying to maneuver around with Mohammed bin Salman for certain gains for the U.S. empire in the region of West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, for being with us. You are the founder of 21st Century Wire, being with us from London to talk about the military capabilities for the Yemeni armed forces against the aggression of Saudi Arabia. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about a decade of revolution in Bahrain.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two